Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Defense Deconstructed on the CGAI Podcast Network. I'm your host and Vice President of the Canadian Global Affairs Institute, Dave Perry. On today's show, which we're recording May 27th, 2020, we're going to be doing a special episode talking with our fellow Adin Duryodhan about her research on right-wing extremist groups and movements in Canada and why individuals join these groups. Adin is a PhD candidate in the Department of Political Science at the University of Toronto, and she was the 2019 recipient of the CGAI Professional Development Fellowship that we hold in conjunction with WIDS, Women in Defense and Security. Adin, welcome to Defense Deconstructed.
Thank you so much for having me.
So before we get into some of the work that you are doing right now for your doctoral studies, why don't you start us off by telling us a little bit about yourself and where you're studying and how you came to be there.
Yes, of course. So my name is Adin, and currently I'm doing my PhD in the Department of Political Science at University of Toronto. And before starting my PhD, I did my bachelor's and my master's also in political science from University of British Columbia. So I'm originally from BC. And I applied to my PhD program because my master's supervisor suggested that I should do a PhD. And we can talk more about that later, if that's a good or a bad thing to listen to your master's supervisor. But that's how I applied to the program. And my research is focused on studying extremist groups. More specifically, I study like right-wing extremist groups in Canada and why people join them. And in addition to doing my PhD, I have also been working as a student and a casual for a couple of government departments. So till now, I work with public safety, DND, and global affairs. And when I'm not doing studying, I do improv and stand-up comedy. So that's like my balancing thing with the stress of PhD. That helps me. That keeps me sane so that I don't get too distressed by reading so much about political stuff every day.
Okay, well, that's good to keep in mind. So how did you come to be studying extremism?
So I remember in my third year of undergrad, I took a security studies class, and that was one of the most fascinating classes I took because the class was not just focused on extremism. It was talking about weak states and insurgencies and why people join extremist groups, and also why there are different kinds of extremist groups all around the world, why some attack civilians, why others fight government. So it was a broad overview of the whole literature. And I really liked that. So I continued to take more security studies classes in my undergrad. Then I applied for my master's because I wanted to do a master's right away. And during my master's, I continued to study insurgencies, and my master's thesis was focused on studying the effectiveness of U.S. drone policy in the context of Pakistan and Yemen. So that was a great learning experience for me. I learned about not just new technology, but also how it impacts different terrorist groups. And surprisingly, I thought that, you know, there were general consensus at the time was drones create more problems than they solve because they often kill civilians as well. And that is true. But I found was that their effectiveness depended a lot on the structure of terrorist groups. So if it was a hierarchical terrorist group, so you have a leader at top, then you have the deputies, and then you have like the recruits. So it's very triangly organized. So in that group, if you kill the leader, then yeah, there's a bigger chance that a terrorist group would disintegrate. But if the terrorist group was already disintegrated, like if it was like a network kind of a structure, so you have one node in one like area and another node in another area. So even if you kill the leader of one node, the other node still keeps operating. So my conclusion was, or my finding was, that the effectiveness of drone strikes depends on the structure of the terrorist. And when I finished my master's, my supervisor suggested that I am very interested in this topic. It seems like I'm very passionate about it. And he suggested that I apply for a PhD, and I applied and I got into University of Toronto.
Okay, fantastic. And then here we are a couple of years later.
Yes, still here. We are still here a couple of years later.
Okay, but now, you're still studying extremism, but from a different perspective. So why don't you explain a little bit about what the research project entails and how you're going about doing that?
So I applied in 2015. And when I applied, my application was based on the proposal that I will study ISIS, and more specifically foreign fighters who are joining ISIS, because at that time, that was a big issue. Why are men and women from Western countries, including from Canada, are joining this, you know, horrific terrorist group? But by the time, I got in the program, and by the time I finished my coursework and finished my comprehensive exams, that was in mid of 2017, so summer of 2017. By the end of the summer, the Charlottesville rally happened in the United States. And at that time, my supervisor suggested that I might want to look at right-wing extremism because it is an emerging problem. There is not a lot of research, particularly in the Canadian context. And by the time I will finish my PhD, my research will be of more value because a lot of people are already studying groups like ISIS and Al-Qaeda, but not a lot of people are studying right-wing extremist groups. So that's how I forayed into still studying extremism, but right-wing extremism.
And so before we get into some of the specific things that you're looking at, what when you talk about right-wing extremism, like what's the universe of cases or the potential examples of groups that you're actually looking at? What defines them and differentiates them from other groups?
Yeah, so that's a good question. And this is still a work in progress because the term right-wing extremism is not very clearly defined in existing literature, but it includes themes of like nationalism, which is often driven by racism or xenophobia. So it is not your like day-to-day patriotism. It has a very specific xenophobic angle to it. Sometimes it holds the perception that the government is illegitimate or it should not hold any authority over the movement. There is a desire to preserve an imagined heritage or a homeland. And it also includes like extreme manifestations of like ideological or religious superiority. There is also the idealization of a conservative, traditional, male-dominated, heterosexual families. And there is a loathing almost of like interracial marriage or homosexuality or mixed procreation. So it is like, it's a big, what can you say, like a part of these ideas. And part of my research is while I study different groups who come under the rubric of right-wing extremism, either defined by other academics or the way media portrays them. So I look at all of them and see which part of right-wing extremism they come under. The difference, though, if I were to very broadly, because my research is still ongoing, if I were to differentiate, let's just say, between some of the right-wing extremist groups in Canada versus some of the right-wing extremist groups in the US, you could say that while in the US, the racial part is very prominent, like they have no problem directly saying why whites are superior or using the term being white as, you know, without fearing that it is somehow will put them in a situation where they will not be received well. Like they are very open in talking about race and racial superiority. The Canadian right-wing extremist groups, as defined by other academics and sometimes in the media, they use the term, they use terms couched in cultural superiority. So they wouldn't say like whites are better. They would might say like Canadian values. We love Canadian values and people who come here should follow Canadian values. And anybody who doesn't follow them is somebody like we don't want. So it's almost, you can say that like, because every extremist group wants to portray themselves as non-extremists or somehow want to become more palatable to a general audience. So if in Canada, we generally have an official multicultural policy, we know that our country is generally more welcoming to immigrants than some of the other countries in Europe and even in the US. So our extremist groups are also adapting language, which they think our audience might respond to in a better way than being more provocative.
Okay. And so the specific focus of what you're doing is looking at motivations to join. Is that right?
Yes. So my dissertation question is, while I study the right-wing movement more generally, my question is, why do men and women join these groups?
And I guess so, first principles, why does that matter?
Why the question matters?
Right. So what are you looking at to try to, from a policy point of view, be able to help identify ways that you can identify people susceptible to join? Or more broadly, why is that a question that you're not only devoting a significant chunk of your time to, but one that has a broader importance in terms of the impact of the research beyond whether or not you get your degree or not?
Yeah, so definitely, like policy question is a big one, like because starting in 2017, when my supervisor suggested I study, her point was that this could become a bigger problem going forward, including in Canada. So I wanted to study it, you know, if as it's becoming a problem or the way it's evolving. And the way I'm studying is, or the reason why I wanted to focus on this question is that the traditional literature on recruitment focuses often on individual a lot. So they talk about, oh, what makes this individual join? Did they have a grievance? Did they have a mental health condition? Did they come from like maybe an abusive background? Or so it focuses a lot on individual. Whereas what I'm trying to do in my research is to broaden the argument that instead of just looking at the individual, we have to look at the broader socio-political context as well, because extremism thrives in a context. This is not just an individual thing, because if it was an individual thing, there is not a lot that a government can do. Like, it's very unlikely that you can go in and change somebody's, like, government can go in and change somebody's, like, psychological drive. But like, what government could do, or what the, from a policy perspective, like, you can change or work on the societal conditions that might make it more, that might make it easier for some extremist ideas to thrive. So the goal was to, that when studying people who are joining these groups, to look at not only at the individual as an individual, but also the conditions surrounding that individual, because if we have to make policies, that's where policy work can happen in a much more, I guess, useful way.
Okay. And so this is obviously something that I would imagine it would be fairly difficult to actually go about and conduct field research on, but I know that you're doing that. So what, talk a little bit about how you're actually trying to answer that question.
Yes, it is very, very difficult. It is a lot more difficult than I thought it would be. So, I mean, it was always a question, like, just to give you like an example, my ethics application took a year to get approved. So generally, like, people's ethics, like, we just kept going back and forth. They had so many questions. So I had to do so many revisions just on my ethics application. So I'll tell you first how I try to do it and then the problems that I face. So in order to recruit individuals, I try like two or three different things. So first is that I go to the public rallies. So the thing with right-wing extremism in Canada is because a lot of these groups are not on terrorist entity lists. So they can still organize and public and protest. So no matter how much you disagree with their protest, they have a right to gather and protest, which is not a case with some of the like religious extremist groups in Canada. So because of that, they can gather in public. So I go to these protests, I introduce myself, I tell them this is what I'm studying and if they would like to participate in my research. So that's one way I try to recruit them. And another way I do it is that I just go on social media, look at the public social media profiles. So people whose Facebook and Twitter pages are public and they very publicly mention that they are part of this group or that group, or they believe in this thing, or they would have a slogan or something like that. And then I just like send them a message. And the third way is that once I interview somebody, I ask them. So it's like a snowball method. I ask them if they have friends or other people in the movement or in their group that might also be interested in being part of my study. And if so, please connect us. So that's the third way I do it. The thing though is that I get a lot more no's than yeses. So a lot of people do not want to participate in my research. However, the ones who do, they are very open about talking, because for them, it's almost like somebody is giving them attention. They like the idea that somebody's interested in what they have to say. And another thing I want to add is that when I started my research, a lot of people said that you are a woman or you are not white, so they might not want to talk to you. Surprisingly, that was not a barrier. I don't think that was a barrier, because when they talk to me, they sometimes mention themselves that you are not white, I'm talking to you, how can I be a racist? So it's almost as if for them, it's a proof that because they're talking to me, they cannot be racist or as bad as some people are saying that they are. And I also think being a woman is helpful because you come across as non-threatening, or they don't see you as threatening, where I've heard some of my male colleagues or like men who are in other countries who are doing this research is that maybe sometimes they would find another man to be a lot more threatening, that maybe they could get in a fight with them or something if they were to do a one-on-one interview, or it would be a bit more threatening. But with me meeting in a coffee shop, oh, and I always meet in public. Like, that's another thing. I always meet in a public place. So that's not something that they find threatening. So while I get a lot more no's than yeses, I don't think it has more to do with my identity. I think it's just that they don't want to participate in my research. because they think that academics are traditionally left-wing and might not present their views in like in a light that they want them presented.
Listening to an episode of Defense Deconstructed on the CGAI Podcast Network. These engaging conversations from the front lines of policy and politics are brought to you by the Canadian Association of Defense and Security Industries.
Okay, wow. So that's really fascinating that you're finding that. In terms of the response rate that you get, are you getting enough that you're confident about the research track that you're on and that it's going to be a feasible project?
The COVID has made it a bit difficult because up till now, like my goal was to finish it by the end of the summer. And I was hoping for somewhere between 35 to 40 first-hand interviews. And this is another thing, like a lot of the research on recruitment does not focus, the researchers, like most of the previous research is not focused on primary source interviews. Most of the research is focused on secondary sources, like media reports, police reports, court documents. Whereas this one, my goal was to get primary source data because it's a innovative or a new contribution to the literature. But because I might not have a representative sample, if I want to finish on time, I think I'm in discussion with my supervisor now. I think we would change our research design a bit. So I will keep the interviews that I have. It would be less than 40. And then it complemented with secondary source research about some of the profiles. So we are definitely going to have to be a bit more creative because I also want to finish on time.
Right. As someone that didn't finish on time, I can tell you that that's important.
Yes.
So with what you've done so far, do you have any kind of sense of some preliminary findings that you can share and that you think are that you're able to talk about at this point in time?
Yeah, so of course. So one thing that I find, so there's a couple of things. So I'll start with one. So most of the time they do not like labels. So they like, even when I send them an initial email, like I am studying right-wing extremist groups in Canada, they're like, I'm not extremist or I am not right-wing or I don't even believe in like left or right-wing. Like these are just labels. And they would just give reasons of why they are in a particular group or in a particular movement. And reason could be like economic or immigration, or they just don't like Trudeau and all of these, like depends on individual. So there's a multitude of reasons, but they themselves don't like to call themselves right-wing or extremists. The second thing I found is that the narrative of grievance is very interesting. So in groups like when people study like ISIS and Al-Qaeda, one of the things previous research found was that the often individuals would join who had a sense of grievance that something was taken from me, either my, either I face racism or my family in another country or my just the broader community that I identified with in another country is being attacked. So I have to join and protect them. Whereas what I'm finding in right-wing extremist group is that they sometimes talk about their grievances, like, okay, so they also might come from a lower socioeconomic background or somebody, lost their job or things like that. But they often preface it as, but that is not why I joined this group. It's almost like they want to defend. It's almost like they expect me that once they share something, a grievance from their past, I will automatically assume that that's why they joined. So they kind of anticipate that and clarify it for me. So the minute they mention something, oh, I lost my job and it was very difficult, but that is not why I joined this group. And they continue on when they're talking about their grievance, they specifically say like the grievance did not make them join. In fact, it made them the person who they are. So the grievance part is almost related to a resilience, that it made them particularly resilient. And their problem is that if I could do it, if I could find another job, if I brought up a family, if I did all these things despite having these difficulties, what are these other people complaining about? And these other people could be like refugees who want to come in and people who are on welfare or anybody else that they feel is not doing their part in society. So that was interesting that instead of you seeing grievance as something that pushed them into this movement, they see grievance as something that made them resilient. They overcame it and now they're part of this movement. because they want other to overcome their grievance as well. Another interesting thing is that, so this goes back to my previous point about in Canada, these groups using a cultural narrative and not a racial narrative. And they also support it by saying that they have people of color in their movement. And that is true. They do have people from South Asian background, some from Southeast Asian background in their groups. And these people show up at protests. And oftentimes they take pictures and they put the pictures of their protest, which has people of color in it. And sometimes they will take pictures of a counter protest or Antifa saying that they are the ones who are all white, and put them side by side to say that they are diverse. But what I'm finding is that while that is true, that there are people, and I've talked to like a couple of people of color who are part of these movements, they seem to have joined these groups like of their own accord or independently. But I think that's my analysis. I think they are accepted because these people of color agree with the hierarchical narrative of the leaders of these groups. So these people agree that, of course, Canada is the best country. Why are these other immigrants complaining about anything? I came here. I made something of myself. I am so thankful for this. So why are these other people complaining? Like, just because, you know, they cannot make of themselves what I did. And they say, oh, I speak English, or like I assimilated. So the whole idea of assimilation is very important. Like, these people see themselves as completely assimilated, and they don't talk about their cultural background or their linguistic idea, their linguistic identity as much. So my analysis is that these people are accepted in a broader right-wing group extremist movement because they agree with the dominant narrative of the leaders of this movement, and because they don't fall, they stay in line. I think that the minute any of them started talking about anything related to their cultural background, I don't think they will be that accepted. And I also don't think these people will like move up the ranks or something. Like, I think they are just there because they have this, they help the optics of this movement. And it's the similar thing I'm finding with women too. So the women who join these groups, like, you would think that because they are very male dominated, they believe in a traditional patriarchal heterosexual families. But the women who join these groups have similar ideas. Like, they also accept the hierarchy of how the society should be. And that includes a male head, a male breadwinner, and a woman who is stay at home, or even if she's working, like, her prime responsibilities to the family. So I think when it comes to women and people of color, yes, they are part of these groups, but they are only accepted because they agree with the hierarchical narrative that the mostly white male-dominated leadership of this movement propagate.
Okay, wow. That's really some fascinating early findings. I guess one question just to follow up on that comes to mind is, so you were talking about the different potential influences on people's motivations sort of at the individual level or the wider socioeconomic or political context. How are you going to approach disaggregating those different causal forces?
Right. So in my interview, is based on this, it's called life trajectory interview. And it's this methodology is adopted from criminology. And the interview is divided into three parts. A first part is micro level, which talks about just the individual. So, you know, how it starts asking questions from their childhood, like where they were born, how was the family environment, and how many siblings they had, how were they in school, you know, if they ever got in any trouble with the law or bullies or anything like that. So that's the first part. The second part of the interview is focused on the meso level, which talks about the broader social network. So whether it was the work or families, or if they are part of, you know, any political group, even a local soccer club, you know, so it looks at what are the social networks that an individual is a part of. And the third part of the interview is called the macro level, which looks at the social political issues that a person cares for, or the issues that are important to him or her. And of course, like, because it's qualitative data, right? So it won't be coded with 100% accuracy, because we're still dividing these things with some subjectivity. But the goal at the end, when the data will be analyzed, like, more fully, once I collect more of it too, the goal is to see instead of looking at individual causes, because I do understand that would be very difficult because it's every person's life is so complicated and a multitude of factors collide. So instead of looking at factors or what traditional researchers would call variables, I'm looking at levels. And my goal is to at the end to see if I can maybe make an argument that one of these levels is more important than another. Like maybe meso is more important than macro, or micro is more important than meso. So instead of looking at individual variables, I'm looking at levels and seeing and trying to figure out which one is probably more important that mobilizes somebody into joining an extremist group. And one other thing that I've found so far, so it's not a complete finding, it's just what I have so far and might change as my research progresses. What I find is that the right-wing groups in Canada are very fragmented, and this aligns with previous research of scholars such as Dr. Marcus Carey and Ryan Scrivens, who have also made the argument that right-wing groups in Canada are very fragmented. They often fight with each other as well. They know what they are opposed to, but they cannot agree what they are for. So that's why there is a lot of infighting. And they keep like breaking up, and then people keep moving around. But whenever I ask these people about, you know, the potential of violence, or if they see right-wing movements in Canada becoming violent, their response is twofold. Like first, they tell me that, oh, the Canadians are so nice to be violent. So I think it's not that these groups or these individuals do not want violence. I think from their perspective, because they also want the broader public to like them and they want their message to resonate with the broader public. I think if at the moment they're not becoming violent, that is one of the reasons, because they don't see that violence will be appreciated or be accepted by the broader Canadian society. So they might hold off on that. Having said that, there is still a possibility of like more lone actors or like, you know, an individual such as the Quebec mosque shooter, Alex Bissonnette. That possibility still remains, but I think if you're looking at groups overall, no group is, groups might not like organize and commit organized violence at this moment, just because they know it will not be taken well by the broader public. And also because they are very fragmented, they keep fighting with themselves. So they might not get organized well in the first place.
Okay. So, Adam, since you're still doing the research, if folks want, are you still open to suggestions or inputs on people that are interested in the work that you're doing?
Yes, please, because I'm still like collecting my data. I'm still in the middle of it. So this is actually a very good time for me to get suggestion, feedback. How can I improve my research? If there are people have ideas on how to analyze it better, I'm open to all feedback.
Okay, so if anyone is in that position and they want to get in touch with Adam and discuss some of the work that she's doing, you can get in touch with her through us at contact@cgai.ca, or you can reach out to us on any of our social media platforms. So, Adam, thanks for that overview and sharing with us what you're doing in terms of your research. When you're not reading such weighty things as extremist motivations, what else are you reading these days?
Okay, so as I said before, I do stand-up comedy on the side. And so I'm reading this book. It's called Comedy Writing for Late Night TV. It's by Joe Toplin. And this book is about how to write monologue jokes. So if you watch late night shows, whether it's Colbert or Conan, you know, they do that monologue, right? Like 5 to 7 minutes in the beginning. And surprisingly, it takes a lot of time just to like write that 5 to 7 minute segment. They have a whole team whose only job is to work on that monologue. So that's what I'm reading, because I think the way the PhD job market is going, we need to keep our options open. So if academia or government doesn't work for me, I am pouring into late night comedy writing.
Okay, so you're keeping that third option open, Lab, of comedy. Yes. That's fantastic.
Yes, I am.
And thanks so much for joining us today on Defense Deconstructed.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for tuning into this week's episode of Defense Deconstructed, part of the CGAI podcast network. Our guest this week was Adam Duryodhan. If you like the show, please remember to rate us and leave a comment on your podcast app. And if you like our stuff, please feel free to check out our donation page at cgai.ca/donate. You can also find us on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. The podcast is brought to you by our team in Ottawa. And thanks go out to the producer, Jay Rankin, and Drew Phillips for providing our music. I'm Dave Perry, and thanks for listening to this episode of Defense Deconstructed.